had a question for Mara.
Mara,
sorry. I just wanted to get a little bit more of a sense from you, but this is specifically about the comments you were making at the start of your paper about sort of what constitutes cyber terrorism and how that's kind of located, I guess, in all the debates about what constitutes terrorism. I wanted to get a sense from you about what's at stake in that kind of discussion. Why is it important for you to kind of draw boundaries around what you consider terrorism to be? Because in other instances, you didn't seem that bothered about using the term to describe certain types of actions, although I was struck that you tend to define it in terms of actions, but you didn't. All the examples were of non-state actors sort of employing terrorism. So I kind of, just a broad question. Why is this important?
It's not that I, so for starters, it's not that I don't think that states can engage in terrorist actions. It depends on how you conceive of terrorism, once again. So you can just return to what most people in terrorism studies up until quite recently have talked about are sub-state organizations. Why? Well, because they're, I suppose, following this Weberian dictum that states have a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. So anybody else who then engages in violence is either a criminal, or if they're trying to overthrow the state, then you may be involved in terrorism. The other way, of course, that you could conceive of terrorism is as just a strategy or a tactic that absolutely anybody can use, including the state. So they're certainly interesting distinctions, I think, to think about and to analyze and whatnot. And there's a massive literature out there about both of these. For myself, I think I generally, my interest is in sub-state political violence actors. And I generally employ these terms, terrorists and sub-state political violence actors, interchangeably, for a number of different reasons. One of them is that some people object to the use of the word terrorism, and some people actually object to the use of sub-state political violence actors because they're going to say, well, why are you using euphemisms? Why don't you just call them terrorists? Okay, so I think that people have to work that one out for themselves. You know, there is, like I said, there's no universally accepted definition of terrorism, and I can't change that. I don't have one. So, famously, a Supreme Court judge in the United States talking about porn said, you know it when you see it. Well, people feel the same way about terrorism a lot of times. They think they know it when they see it. But, of course, it depends on your politics a great deal of the time also. So, when it comes to the cyber terrorism issue, so then just to say about where I stand, I'm not somebody who feels like we should be inflating the concept of terrorism to include more and more types of activities or types of attacks, etc. And certainly then when it comes to the cyber terrorism issue, I think there is a couple of important things. One of them has to do with the violence issue, but one of them also has to do with the politics issue, because a deal of the time now people take the politics out of it on the other hand too. So it's not an either or situation with the politics and the violence for terrorism. It only is politics plus violence. That's the minimum kind of requirement for something to be terrorism. And still, of course, I mean, politics and violence, like I said, applies to many, many things. So there's a whole lot of other issues then that it's possible to debate on. But I don't really think it's possible to debate on these two. So going to the cyber terrorism thing then, there's a question about virtual violence, what constitutes violence in cyberspace. And I suppose I'm somebody who feels like for something to be construed as terrorism in a very basic kind of fashion, you can't be talking about, putting somebody out, costing them a few dollars, even if it's a few million dollars, actually, that it's got to be about more than that. And generally, it's got to be about violence against persons. Now, if you want, we could keep going. You can keep going with this, because there's questions then about repeated acts. So if you've carried out one spectacular terrorist attack that's killed thousands of people, well then other attacks to follow up on that are clearly terrorist attacks, most people would agree, even if, for example, they didn't have the same violence component, but then other people would disagree with that also. So there's a whole lot of other issues then that have to be kind of brought into the mix. Does that?
Yeah.
Okay. Lady Brant was next.
Hazel Smith from the Politics Department. I've got a question to the first speakers and to the second speaker, and not to the third one, because I agree with most of the third one. So the question to the first speaker is, your premise, unless I got it wrong, was that international criminal gangs operate in more or less the same way as international terrorist gangs. Now, I'd like you to discuss that a little bit, because one of the things that I've learned, particularly from my work with the United Nations over the last 10 years, is that in policy terms, you have to think very, very differently about international criminal gangs and international terrorist gangs. For instance, if you get security training in the United Nations, which I've been through, if you're taken hostage by a criminal gang, there are certain ways you can deal with it, and you hope you're going to be taken hostage by a criminal gang. If you're taken hostage by what I understand you mean by a terrorist gang, you've got big problems, because there are different sorts of ways that these operate. And I think that's, if we're talking about the issue of terrorism as related to politics and violence, then what the last thing that international criminal gangs want, even with cyber issues, is political instability. They need political stability in order for their outlaw organisations to be able to operate, particularly the big gangs, the Yakuzas, the Triads, and the people that you're talking about. So I think that there's quite a fundamental difference, and that this is consequential for understanding of the things that we're talking about just now. And my second question is not, it's a comment really to the colleague from the Annenberg, a colleague of my old friend Monroe Price.
He's at Annenberg in Pennsylvania.
Oh, Pennsylvania.
I know, yes.
It's not really about cyber-terrorism, but you did raise the issue, you went on a little bit about ethics, the issue of ethics and terrorism. And again, just for your knowledge, one of the things that we're going to have to do with academics in Britain, by law, is that if we have an overseas student who doesn't come to class for more than 10 days, we're going to have to report them because of the new war on terror type frameworks, which is going to cause us all sorts of similar tensions in terms of things that you describe between journalism and the issues of your responsibility as a citizen, and it's as yet unknown how that will play out.
Okay, so I'll try, if you like, respond first.
Yes, concerning your first question, of course we totally agree with you. We do this fundamental distinction between these two type of actors. It's impossible to have the same analysis of any national gangs, and I think that the word gang has to be used only for infra-regional criminal organizations, but it is another debate. But we do this fundamental distinction between two types of organizations that have not only a political objective. Al-Qaeda has not any political objective in it, but ideological objective, including political and religious objectives. First type of actor we consider. And other type of actor we consider, criminal actors that have a financial objective, that want to make money, to make profit. The strategy of these actors is rent-seeking oriented and only profitability. These actors are nothing but criminal companies. Okay, so we do this fundamental distinction, of course. It's impossible to work on this issue without doing it, precisely. First point. Secondly, and I think that the example you gave of kidnapping is a very good example of this need to make this very clear distinction. A kidnapping can have two types of objectives. There exist political kidnappings and economical kidnappings. And to do this distinction, we work in, unfortunately, wonderful laboratory for kidnapping, which is Colombia. We work with the GAULAS, the anti-kidnapping units of Colombia. In Colombia coexist the two types of kidnapping. You have political kidnappings and economical kidnappings done by the same groups. For example, the FARC, they still hold about 700 hostages. About 50, exactly 48 of these hostages were taken only for political reasons. For example, Mrs. Ingrid Betancourt, the Colombian and French citizen. But the rest of the hostages were taken only to make money, only for the payment of the ransom. So, of course, we do this distinction. problem concerning this distinction we have to do as researchers is that more and more we see, we observe that certain groups come from ideological objectives and go to financial objectives. They become not gangs, not terrorists, but gangs terrorists. For example, what is called today Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, the former GSPC, I'm sure you know GSPC in French, Groupement Salafiste pour la Prédication et le Combat, basically Algerian terrorist organization. The GSPC has done kidnappings, for example, to stay on this example of kidnapping, has done kidnapping for the two reasons. To make money, you know, they kidnapped in 2003 32 hostages in the southern part of Sahara, you know, to make money, to earn money. But of course, each day they tried to kidnap expatriates only for political reasons in the same time. You know, more and more terrorist organizations show that they have both, that they have the two objectives in the same time. For example, that the Asian terrorist organization Abu Sayyaf. Of course, they are jihadists, but in the same time, they are pirates. You know, they do drugs traffics more and more, and some of them are totally drunk all the time. You know, the former chief of Abu Sayyaf, the Commandant Wilbert, was killed 2 years ago in jail. He was totally drunk during the negotiations for the kidnap of the Jolo case. Okay, so we do this distinction, but it is more and more difficult to do it. Why? Because some of the terrorist organizations, they change their objectives. First point. For example, for the FARC, you know, today it is absolutely evident that the FARC in Colombia are the first producers of cocaine in the world. It is evident. Marulanda, the number one of the FARC, has great houses in the jungle. It is evident. But is it possible to think that the Talibans, who are the biggest producers of heroin in the world, not cocaine, but heroin, is it possible to consider that Talibans are drug traffickers? Of course not. But they both use drugs traffics to make money. The Talibans use drugs to finance the fight. The FARC use drugs to become richer and richer and richer. They clearly today are here. Yeah. So this distinction is more and more difficult to do. Why? Because of the financement of terrorism. To finance the action, terrorist organizations have to be involved in criminal economy. It is one of the ways they use to finance the action. So the only way to do this distinction is to work on the field, keeping this criminal map in the head. Did I answer? Yeah.
Philip, would you like to
just very briefly, I certainly agree with your point, and that's one of the great challenges in the era of terrorism is maintaining ethical standards, maintaining legal standards. A huge debate in the United States now about how much freedom has to be or should be given up in order to combat terrorism, and that's a very slippery slope, because once you start doing that, they win, for one thing, and when you surrender basic freedoms and you say, well, it's in the cause of fighting terrorism, or you surrender ethical standards, and that's another area that the public needs to think about more, and I think the news media have a role in that too, in helping stimulate that debate. But I certainly agree with your basic point.
Jackie.
Hi, Jackie
Hudson
from the law school. I have a question for, is it Maura? And really following on from the first question, I just wanted to draw you a bit more on the definition of terrorism. So obviously, as a lawyer, I'm coming from that from a legal perspective. Legal definitions of terrorism are not politics and violence. We now have the expansion of the definition of terrorism, which is around glorification, around gathering of information, and so on. We saw the conviction of the so-called lyrical terrorist last autumn, which was about, again, publishing things on the internet and so on. And so I just wondered how you would take that on board in terms of your notion of cyber terrorism and the what your definition of terrorism might be, the way that that might link with a criminal definition, and therefore if I could see actually many more things that might possibly count, if you like, as cyber terrorism, and where this kind of, it has to be politics, it has to be violence, it has to be breaking things and killing people, where that's come from.
Well, at the present time, just for an example, with regard to, some of them are relatively narrow, or at least they're relatively narrow on first observation. For example, the US